on certain angling licenses, on ocean trawl, salmon fishery permits, on Columbia River gillnet fishery permits, and on poundage of food fish imposed for fish restoration and enhancement program. Takes effect on 91st day following the adjournment and sign you die. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
As such, members of the committee, we would understand that our position in this committee is to look at and debate the policy issue. It is not to debate the specific amount of the fees that are being charged or might being charged. So we will say, try to confine our discussions on these areas mostly to policy issues, if it's good policy or bad policy, and leave it to Ways and Means to decide how much money they're going to extract or not going to extract from people. Okay? And who do we have testifying in behalf of the bill? We'll start off with Pete.
Well, we'll go in a minute.
We'll know in a minute. Okay. I assume Mr. Bowles is going to be first somewhere along in here. Do you have a testimony on this bill, Ed? We'll start then with you.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I also have with me Tom Stahl, who is the Project Coordinator for the Restoration and Enhancement Program. Real pleased to be here today to share with you a little background and discussion on the RNE program. We view this as a real cornerstone for some of our department activities and a very important piece of our arsenal in getting projects and activities on the ground benefiting sport and commercial fishers and fisheries. House Bill 2259 extends the Fish Restoration Enhancement Program sunset, and it would extend it an additional 6 years through 2009. It maintains the sport angling license surcharges as well as the salmon fishing permit surcharges and the commercial salmon poundage fee. That's how it's brought about. Just a brief overview. It's aimed at improving sport and commercial fisheries and the populations that these fisheries depend on. It's created by the Oregon Fisheries Restoration Enhancement Act of 89 and was reauthorized in 91 and 97. Just a bit of a schematic to let you understand how the money is brought to bear on important projects for both sport and commercial fishers. You have these sport and commercial fishers that are actually funding this program. So this is a direct fee, I guess, based on those that are using it. These dollars through these surcharges and fees come into the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Then you have public entities and nonprofit organizations that come together with proposals. They submit that what they would like to have funded with these on-the-ground proposals. And that goes to an R&E board, which is another citizen board made up of the same basic components that are funding this program. And that's three sport, three commercial, and one public at large representative, so a seven-person board. They recommend to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission on projects for funding, which then allocate the money back to these public entities and nonprofit organizations. Now here, this next one's an important part because for a lot of these, particularly on the enhancement side of the program, this money is then leveraged with other matching dollars to get the sport and commercial fishery benefits that we have in this program.
Ed?
Yes.
You're back. On the matching dollars, could you help me a little bit with where, kind of in general, some of those matching dollars are coming from?
Chair Jensen, they can come from any sources. There's no limits on the matching source within the statute or legislation. So it can come from sport fish restoration dollars, which is a federal aid program. It can come through OWEB or Watershed Enhancement Board monies, federal salmon recovery dollars. It can come through the various general funds and license funds that we have within our programs as well, and private matches and grants as well. So any of a number.
Could you give me just some kind of an estimate of the total match, other dollars, what percent comes from OWEB?
Chair Jensen, I can't right now. I'll see if Tom Stahl has that. If not, we may have to round that up for you.
Chair Jensen, I don't have those specific figures right now. I would say 10% or less probably come from OWEB. As a guess.
Yeah, okay. The guess is fine. Good. Thank you.
It's still on the fish. That's my favorite for the day.
Now, as far as the funding itself, where the money comes from, there's a $2 surcharge on all resident annual angling licenses. Then we also have on the commercial side the troll permit, the gill net permits, and then just a straight commercial poundage fee that generate these dollars. And then the money that goes out is the statute requires that there be a somewhat of a balance between both the restoration side and the enhancement side, and I'll get in and explain the difference between those two in a second. And also that there is some adherence to ensuring that the proportion of money spent is consistent to the sport and commercial contributions. As far as the during the program, which first was funded in January of 1990, so for over a decade of activity, we've got over $27 million that have come in through these surcharges, and just over $26 million that have gone out. And as I mentioned before, Chair Jensen, this gets at some of the leveraging going on with these dollars. Total project costs that have been supported through this have been over $60 million. And the current biennium revenue is about $3.2 million. The restoration side of R&E is basically for maintenance, repair, replacement of existing structures and equipment supporting fisheries and fish populations. Contrast that with the enhancement side, which is really getting at new opportunities that will be used to improve or increase these fisheries and fish populations. And we've got some examples we can show you of what have been done. There aren't any project types for the restoration that are mandated somewhat within the statute are hatchery repair and maintenance, liberation equipment, in other words, trucks to release fish, fishway and screen maintenance. The enhancement side is a little bit more diverse. You have angler access, educational programs, hatchery production itself, habitat improvement, research and monitoring, and new hatchery technologies, as well as new fishways and screens as opposed to the maintenance and the restoration. Some examples of some restoration projects. One is at Butte Falls Hatchery, improvements to that hatchery. Seven different grants totaling just under $1 million that have been run the gamut of piping to intake, screen and bypass installations, alarm systems, pollution abatement upgrades to get at some of our DEQ requirements, as well as some pond modifications. Others, these are on the restoration side, include trucks for releasing fish produced, Trask hatchery pond liner, and Roaring River hatchery auxiliary generator. All of these very important, real-time, on-the-ground projects that keep activities moving forward on these hatchery programs. Enhancement projects, some examples. One that very, very pleased with is the Nehalem Hatchery Handicap Fishing Pier, extremely popular. It extended the handicap pier, provided more parking, handicap-friendly restroom, and as well as some riparian restoration and an interpretive trail. Very, very popular project. This gets at several things all at once, both the access issue and the educational side. Winchester Dam Education and Passage. This is three different grants and educational signs, viewing area, fish ladder, which was actually out of the restoration funds, and some safety issues that are both R&E funds. The educational side of the viewing area has been incredibly popular for those people in this area.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz. Yeah, just kind of an aside from your last slide. Do you guys have significant ADA issues? The Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yes. Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, with respect to these projects or agency-wide?
Agency-wide access issues, stuff like that. I mean, is that a kind of a burning thing with you?
As I understand, we do have some things that we are continuing to work on with some of our facilities, but in general, we are ADA consistent. But I would have to get back to you on an agency-wide perspective on that. I know we have been, as we've become available, we've been modifying some of our visitor centers, hatcheries and others, to have ADA ramps as well as fishing access too. There has been some issues with respect to once it becomes an ADA site, it has to be non-prejudiced towards just a particular disability.
Right.
And we had a situation on the Nehalem, basically, that it was usual and accustomed as a wheelchair access site, and found out that that had to be for anybody with any disability equal access to that. And so that's something we're working through right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of an aside on something that I was curious about.
Other types of projects within the enhancement program are the Young's Bay net pens, very important for the commercial fishery, fall chinook rearing, and coho acclimation. Diamond Lake stocking and mapping. As you're well aware, this has been a tremendous challenge for our agency. Two different grants here dealing with rearing and release of the experimental spring chinook for 2 years, and there in the lower right is not the goal of this program, to get these big lunkers out of here. And that other picture in the center is not a footprint of a Bigfoot there. That's actually an aerial photo showing how they're doing some mapping on the system to try to they're also doing the bathymetry mapping in order to determine exactly the volume of the water and how many tui chub are actually in there. So this money is very important in helping set us up for some long-term decisions on how to manage that system. And the Nehalem smolt survival study is another example. This was studying smolt migration, estuarine survival of these smolts, as well as the predation on them. And it's done through acoustic and radio telemetry work. Last example I've got for you is Alsi Hatchery Fishway. This was both restoration and enhancement dollars that provided passage at the hatchery diversion dam. Now, just a few impacts. If the House Bill 2259 should fail, we believe there would be less ability for us to achieve our central mission, which is fishery conservation and use. Less opportunity for sport and commercial fishers as a consequence, as well as our ongoing hatchery maintenance and production issues that, as you're well aware, are insignificant funding challenges. Fewer step activities, because R&E does fund a substantial portion of these step activities. And I think perhaps most important from my perspective is fewer local initiatives to benefit fish and fishing. That's really been the strength of R&E. It's a very small administrative program with only one half-time coordinator and a full-time administrator. And the rest of this money really goes for on-the-ground projects, real-time, real issues that keep the wheels greased, if you will, for many of these important production and enhancement programs. Any questions, Mr. Chair? We can take them now.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks. I do have one.
Wait a minute. Representative Florence.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder, and then you.
I beat you to the punch on that. Thanks, Ed, for the good overview of the R&E program. I have a couple of questions about how the projects that you fund relate to the OEB-funded projects, and also, if you, I'm just not as familiar with the R&E program. Can you explain how, that's number one, and two is how these projects are consistent with the species that we're working to protect under the Oregon plan?
Sure. Chair Jensen and Representative Dingfelder, there's some parts of this, as you remember, under the enhancement side of this, in the original statute, it did identify habitat measures as an important part of R&E. That has not been the real strong focus of recent time because there is an alternative funding source for those through OEB. So the focus for this program during recent times has really been on direct benefits to sport and commercial fisheries. And in doing so, the important part there is ensuring that as we provide those fishery opportunities, we do so consistent with conservation of these native species. And so there's been a lot of effort to try to keep these projects consistent with what we would view as important for the conservation of native species. Some of the improvements at some of these facilities, and particularly as we head down into the future, we'll want to make sure we do so in a way that takes care of some of the requirements for ensuring that these hatcheries are good residents of their watersheds for water quality and quantity issues, ensure that we're able to manage the fish in these hatcheries such that we can transition towards these local brood stocks for some of these where appropriate, ensure that we have the appropriate acclimation facilities, disease prevention facilities, things like that. And so there will always be, I think, through the R&E board, a keen eye towards those projects that not only are good for fishing but also meet the stewardship mandate of the program. Currently, I am unaware of any formal link between the board, OEB, and the R&E board on project-specific details. Tom, are you aware of any?
No.
Okay.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, and part of the reason I asked that question is to find out, you know, if there's hopefully not overlap or duplication, or if there is, that you guys are working together with a project that OEB's funded. So I don't know if there's any way, you know, for the boards to sort of have some type of communication to make sure they're not working, you know, one agency isn't working against the other agency in funding of their projects. And I know OEB focuses mostly on habitat restoration, but I guess it would be, I would feel better about it just to make sure we're not duplicating efforts or working against each other if there was some formal type of communication.
Chair Jensen, that could certainly take place, and with all projects coming through our commission, it requires an additional hearing, public hearing in front of the commission, and we can certainly formalize within those presentations a section linking this to OEB activities. The other point I'd bring up is the matching opportunities that allow this program or OEB program to actually gain more for a particular project by working together.
So they can match, you can match R&E with
yeah.
OEB funds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Bowles, please forgive my lack of familiarity with the funding and a project overall. On page 3 of your slide or PowerPoint presentation regarding R&E funding, R&E funding in at 27 and out at 26, and the total project costs at $60 million. And where is the balance come of that funding come from?
Chair Jensen and Representative Flores, that is through matching dollars that come from a variety of sources.
That's
whether
what you had mentioned earlier.
Right. Some of it's federal, some of it's other state dollars, some of it is private dollars
thank
through
you.
Grants.
I missed that link.
Okay.
One could also assume that these dollars could be used by somebody else as match also, right? I mean, you can match both ways.
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, yes. I guess it just depends on who jumps on it first.
Well, I think everybody claims that they've got all this match, but the bottom line is the dollars are there. So,
Ed, in relationship to Representative Dingfelder's concern about department and its relationship with OWEB on this and whether there's duplication. In fact, a lot of the R&E development kind of falls outside of OWEB's general jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Jensen. As I mentioned, the piece of the R&E statute that mandates particularly a focus on some habitat improvement things has not been a focus of the board of late simply because of that overlap. And as long as those funds are available through other sources, their emphasis has been on other priorities right now. Okay. And much of this, as you mentioned, is outside of OWEB's authority as well.
That's good. It was that I was referring to. Any other questions? Tom, for the record, would you give us your name? You had a comment that you made, and we don't have that on the record.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Stahl, and I'm the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's Restoration and Enhancement Program Coordinator.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. We have Darlene Klein-Dolby. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Jensen, committee members, heart be still. My name is Darlene Klein-Dolby. I live at 3820 Monroe in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a member of the Emerald Empire chapter of Northwest Steelheaders, a member of the Cascade Fly Fishers, the Oregon Federation of Fly Fishers. I'm also a certified card-carrying master angler. I'm for the angler education program for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm starting a class this
evening.
Does that
mean you would embarrass me if we were out fishing together?
Not at all. I could probably learn something. I'm starting a class tonight teaching Springfield Middle School children basic fishing. So I am involved in the fishing community. I'm also a member of the Restoration and Enhancement Board, and I represent sport fishers. I strongly support the extension of the surcharges and fees for the restoration and enhancement programs. I know firsthand of some of the projects that R&E has helped to fund, and I think it's important to note that R&E may fund a piece of a project, but the rest of the funds come from private organizations, fishing organizations, other governmental parties. And a lot of that comes in the form of bodies, people willing to get out there and do the work. And this, the program gives fishing clubs and organizations a tool. They have the good ideas. They have the manpower and woman power. But they don't have the funding, and this certainly helps them to improve fisheries and fishing opportunities. Ed Bowles pointed out the experimental stocking of fish at Diamond Lake. That was a recent one. The Winchester Dam, the improvement of the Winchester Dam viewing area. I was there not too long ago. What an improvement. It's just, if you ever get a chance, go down there and watch those beautiful fish go up through the fish ladder. There's several other examples that I've outlined there. R&E funds have been used to upgrade and maintain many department facilities. The board receives requests for alarm installations or upgrades, pond repairs, provisions for fish passage, and many, many other maintenance items. I'd hate to see the funding from R&E dry up. I thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. Then we have Les Helgeson. Morning, Les.
Morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Thank you for the correct pronunciation of my name. That happens very rarely. I'd like to submit some comments on behalf of the Native Fish Society concerning this bill. We're an organization, approximately 340 members.
Would you give us, for the record, your name? And
Les Helgeson.
Okay. Thank you.
From Beaver, Oregon, by the way.
Thank you.
And we're an organization dedicated to the conservation of native fish society, or native fish and their habitat. We are opposed to the repeal of the sunset provision of the R&E program. Quite simply, we feel the program has failed to live up to the legislative intent, and therefore should be terminated or perhaps modified, amended in some way. Section 12 of the Act recommends a mix of projects that are supposed to provide a balance between restoration and enhancement benefits, and we don't feel this balance has been achieved since the program's inception back in 1989. And a glaring example of this imbalance is the existing hatchery maintenance backlog. This is a huge issue. Best available information we have is that the current backlog is $26,368,491. An updated maintenance list report was to have been completed in January. We haven't seen it yet. According to some members of the R&E board and others, the actual backlog may be approaching 100 million, and I've stated that on my written testimony. I apologize. It should be 100 million, not 100,000. And I think if you look at the historical intent of this bill, you know, hatchery maintenance was one of the primary impetus driving passage of the R&E program. Conservation organizations, sportsmen, commercial interests, we all supported this attempt to correct some glaring problems at the time. Yet the maintenance backlog hasn't been addressed. It's actually grown considerably. It's a major problem, a real elephant sleeping here. So I don't know. We're seeing new fees and so forth being proposed. This deficit keeps growing. We're very concerned about that, and don't feel that we should reward efficiency, inefficiency with continuation of this surcharge unless some changes are implemented. So I appreciate your consideration of our comments and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Mr. Helgeson, thank you for testifying.
Sure.
I guess if this fee doesn't pass, wouldn't the maintenance problem become worse rather than better?
I don't know. My primary concern would be that the maintenance would be improved. I see very little going to the maintenance of the hatcheries currently, and we would like to see that directed if this fee is, in fact, if the bill is passed. A couple examples, the Trask hatchery, a couple of these hatcheries are slated for closure due to, in part, for example, a Trask hatchery, the manager's housing was so bad that they eliminated the manager because the house was condemned. It was so unsafe. It was unsafe to live in. The rearing ponds at the Cedar Creek hatchery on the Nestucca, where I live, had major DEQ problems. They've had to close the two big rearing ponds there that they relied on because they were not addressed. They should have been, but for some reason the funds had been going elsewhere.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Helgeson.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Tomei.
Okay, I'll take that as a compliment, so will I.
Mutual admiration.
Thanks.
Les, do you have a sense as to, you know, looking at the projects that are funded, I mean, would you recommend sort of a rethinking percentage? I mean, would you like to see, are you proposing sort of a certain percentage that's spent just on hatchery maintenance?
Yes.
And the question I have for Ed is,
do you currently have goals on how much of the R&E money you spend for hatchery versus other programs? And I don't know if you want to come up, Ed. And
well, we'll get him in a minute.
Okay. So is that, I mean, are you looking for specific goals? Because I have the same concern that Representative Tomei does. Mm-hmm. If we don't fund this program, I don't see how it's going to improve. If anything, then the facilities will continue to decline. So right. I guess I'm trying to get at how you propose better accountability for spending this money.
We need to perhaps specify in the bill some percentages. I don't know if that's considered micromanaging, but it was clear that at the time this concept was evolved back in 89 that hatchery maintenance was to be addressed, and it hasn't. The backlog keeps growing, so if the maintenance issue continues to grow, why do we pay the fees if we're not resolving the problems which the bill was originally set out to address? There's really no way of seeing the problem getting worse. It is getting worse with the fees.
Mr. Chair, I just have a comment. I sympathize with your desire to catch up on the maintenance backlog, but I don't think getting rid of this is the way to do it. It would be like mm-hmm. getting rid of the gas tax because the maintenance on our bridges and roads are going mm-hmm. to pot. Well, that doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense to me. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That's a comment. You can comment on my comment if you like.
Certainly. It's not... we'd like to see the funds dedicated more to the purposes for which they were originally intended.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see that occurring, so that's why we are opposing the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Les.
Thank you very much.
Now we have Dave Peters with the STEP, Coquille STEP program. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Jensen and committee members. My name is Dave Peters. I am president of Coquille STEP, member and immediate past chairman of Salmon Trout Advisory Committee, member and past president of Coos River STEP, member and past president of Southwest Chapter of Northwest Steelheaders, past president of Coos Basin STEP, and vice president of Oregonians for Fish and Fishermen. I'm reading this, so please bear with me. I'm speaking in favor of extending the R&E program. One of the questions I like to answer is about OWEB. And how do we know we aren't spending the same funds? In my area, I'm a member of OWEB. Many members of the STEP groups that I've named are also members. So very simply, the reason we don't spend the same money on the same projects is we do a lot of projects together, or we do it individually in each group, but different projects. Never the same project twice. So that's just in my area. I can't speak for the rest of the state, but that's how we do it. This program is not only useful in many programs, but is actually vital for fish health. Now, in my area, we raise, this is the Coos area, Coos and Coquille, we raise millions or hundreds of thousands of fish. We acclimate hundreds of thousands of fish. And one of the hardest problems we had for many years was feeding these fish. It's hard to get enough money to do that. And we spend about 60 to 70% of our time trying to raise the necessary funds to feed the fish. What happened is, due to the R&E program, Tom Rundrick, myself, he's a STEP biologist, we went to the R&E board and asked if they would fund the fish feeding for all the step groups in the state. And that's part of the funding today. What that relieved us to do, us of the step groups and the angling groups, a greater opportunity to do more on the ground than we were doing ever before, primarily from the fact we didn't have to spend all that time trying to raise the money. And so we do very successfully. It's been really helpful. At the same time, at that same meeting, the R&E board ran into a problem, as one of the step groups needed a small amount of money. And it was not an amount the R&E board liked to pull around. I think it was $500. So they asked us what we felt as a stack group, and of course then we went to our coordinator, if we would feel comfortable handling small grants from the R&E board to small step request. And we did that. And that's worked very successfully for us. But actually it's been a little bit too successful, because not only do we have step groups looking for the small grant money, but we also have schools and educators. They found out about it and they said, wow, we can have our kids do in-stream work and work with fish, and all we need to do is get a little help. The neat thing about it is it's matching funds, so most of these programs are actually, there's more money coming from other groups and sources than the R&E money that we give out. I think we have a total of $20,000 a year as a stack group that we give out to the different requests. And we do it at our annual meeting, or our quarterly meetings, or we have five meetings a year. And we then give X amount of dollars at each meeting to these requests. So actually this R&E money is used real well, as far as I'm concerned, in our group. But when you stop and think, when I speak to our group, in our area, in my area, on the south of me is the Curry Anadarous Fishermen. In my area is the Bannon Fishermen Association, the Coquille Step, Coos River Step, the Southwest Branch of the Northwest Steelheaders, Lakeside Step, and Gardner Step. They all are involved. To the south is Florence Step, and of course then you heard Darlene talk about the groups that are up in her area. We get tremendous public support, and if you don't believe it, you should come down to some of our activities. As far as fish raising, a lot of people are concerned about hatchery fish, because hatchery fish are supposed to have an impact or a bad impact on wild fish. In our area, you find we have very strong ones of wild fish as well as strong runs of hatchery fish. Well, there's a reason for it. I think about 1980, we started using wild fish as our broodstock. And every year we mix wild fish with our hatchery fish, a certain percentage every year, and we release them. And we have a very successful fish program. We do it every year, put a certain percentage of wild with our hatchery stock. To give you an example, just one of our step hatcheries, I call it a step hatchery. We do everything but eye the eggs, which is done by the Department of Fish and Wildlife Bannon Fish Hatchery. We started out with about three or four breeding fish the first year. Last year, we had 8,000 Chinook alone returned to the hatchery. We had about an equal amount of coho. We have one of the best runs of coho, wild coho and wild Chinook. So our program is vital as far as we are concerned. We've had some of the best fishing we've ever had. It seemed to get better every year. And It's the same with the Coquille system, and I believe the Umpqua is doing just as well. We don't do anything with the Umpqua, but the Umpqua fishermen do a darn good job. Florence Stepp does a good job. I feel that this program is really vital to our program, just from the fact that it works so well with the volunteers. They can do so many more projects. We do a habitat, we do in-stream work, but a lot of times we're working with the OWEB, and so that's how we get more done. In fact, we have several joint programs with OWEB in our area. We work very good with OWEB. I want to thank you for your time. I hope I answered some of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? Thank you very much.
You're
welcome. Colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2259, and we're going to open a work session on 2259. And the chair would like to have Ed Bowles from the Department of Fish and Wildlife come and address a question for us. Again, for the record, will be needed, of course, Ed, you know, but could you comment for us on what I think is probably an extremely important issue, the issue of maintenance that has been brought up, and what the department currently is doing and what the department might do in sometime in the future?
Chair Jansen, yes, I'd refer you to the annual report that came out that was handed out to you as part of our documents. If you just want a glimpse at for the duration of the program in this past biennium, on page 6, it shows on the page 6 is for the restoration side of the program, which deals with the hatchery maintenance component. And on page 7 is the enhancement side, which doesn't as directly deal with maintenance issues. And all of those projects you see on the left were just the maintenance side of things that were handled through the restoration dollars within this program this past biennium. And as I mentioned during my presentation, the statute requires a balance between the restoration side of this and the enhancement side, with most of the maintenance dollars going from the restoration side of the program. And that was this past biennium approximately $1.6 million, so half of the $3.2 million. Now, as far as the overall hatchery maintenance and deferred maintenance issue, quite correctly, Representative Schaffler mentioned about this is just one tool that we have to address this daunting challenge of hatchery maintenance. It is not adequate through the surcharges currently that we receive to tackle the entire problem of deferred maintenance. And that's going to require, I think, a very coordinated and concerted effort looking at a variety of funding sources and strategies and options. We have a deferred maintenance report that was required for us to prepare for ways and means as one of our budget notes. That is in its final throes of coming out in a final form, and that'll be provided to the legislature very shortly. So that'll describe the current maintenance backlog as well as some strategies perhaps that the legislature can consider and how we can handle that.
Any questions for Ed on this? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bowles, only because I know that if my constituents asked, I would need to be coming up with an answer. So on your list of restoration projects, the Elk River installation of freezer door, $13,750. What kind of freezer door is that? Is that installation labor and parts or what for $13,750?
Chair Jensen and Representative Flores, I'm not totally familiar with all the details, but on that one I assume that represents a full replacement of the freezer door, and these are used to store many of the food products that go into feeding these fish, as well as the parts taken for, you know, some of these are labs. I don't know if Elk River is a lab as well, but that's what that would entail.
Quite sizable.
Yes, yeah, they store all of the fish food for many of these in these compartments.
Mr. Chair?
Ed, allow me to follow up on that. I find that an extraordinary cost for a freezer door. You know, I've been to some big meat processing facilities that have large freezers and they're big doors, but, man, that's a lot of money. And I'm looking here at Fall River to gravel a road for $48,000. That's a lot of gravel.
Huh?
And I'm just... Maybe what you ought to do is bring us back a more detailed list of some of this stuff. I don't want to start nitpicking here, but darn, that's a lot of money for gravel. I just graveled my lane back to my house, and yeah, it's not cheap, but you can build a lot of road for that. So maybe you ought to just give us some further information. It would be very helpful.
There, Chair Jensen and Representative Krupp, there are... We have available more detailed breakdowns. I'd ask, I guess, that you consider those details. Some of these, for example, that may not just include gravel. That may be the actual engineering for a road.
Are you constructing a new road, I guess, Mr. Chair?
I'm not certain in these cases, but I guess before...
Did you want to speak on that?
Tom Stahl can talk to some of the particulars.
Okay.
Again, your name, please, for the record.
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, for the record, my name is Tom Stahl. The project costs listed on page 6 and 7 in here are the amount that was allocated for each project. That doesn't represent how much is actually going to be spent. That's how much that the engineers from the department have put in a request for. They have some contingency funds associated with that. And the title typically just talks about the main feature of the project, and there are other things involved with it. For Fall River, that's a long road. I think it's on a hill coming in, so it's an extensive road leading into it. We can get you more details if that project is completed on what was spent on it. And as far as the freezer door, that's another project where I think an old door was being replaced with a newer one, including engineering design, cost of labor, cost of the door itself, the whole package.
Mr. Chair, if I may, you need to understand we have a certain sensitivity these days around this building to how dollars are being spent after learning about some new furniture being bought on the front page of the Oregonian yesterday. And so... I think it would be helpful in the future just to take note of, if you're going to bring these kinds of dollars in front of us, you probably better be able to answer some questions about it, because we're very curious about these things these days. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Forrest.
And I guess I would add to the list the handrail installation for $53,000 at Oak Springs. Maybe it's a long handrail on a hill. there must be more.
Chair Jensen and Representative Flores, on all these, as Tom mentioned, there is more. This is safety requirements for OSHA related to all the catwalks all along the raceways. And so those are a big requirement, yes.
Mr. Chair. I'm compelled to comment.
Representative Schaffer.
We may find that $50,000 for this road is a bargain. It's possible. I hope it is.
maybe so.
And maybe not. But, you know, we are very sensitive. I agree with Representative Krupp. But I just don't want you all going away thinking that I think you're wasting our money. You know, because if you are, then I'll be upset with you, too. But... $50,000 on a road project is almost nothing. So I just want to share that, my opinion of it.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this bill does go to the Ways and Means, and isn't it in the purview of that subcommittee to get into the details of project funding and the appropriateness of them?
Thank you, Representative Cruz. The chair was about to mention this to the committee, that if we get involved in the fee, or for that matter the line items that we're talking about, the we're a little bit out of our jurisdiction with it. Our function, our purpose in hearing these bills is to look at the policy side. Certainly, representatives, we have a we have, like all other representatives, an obligation to be sensitive to these financial issues. And actually, this point, the chair would comment that when we send this to Ways and Means, if the committee chooses to do so, that these points will be made going to Ways and Means, so that they will be able to know that there were concerns here, and knowing the Ways and Means process and the good chair of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources, I'm sure that these issues will be looked at very carefully before Representative Morgan is inclined to pass out this legislation. So with that, I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 2259 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, understanding that we will send to Ways and Means also our comments and concerns that we have.
So moved. Yeah.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2259 be sent to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a technical concern. The current statute sunsets December 31st, 2003, and this bill is scheduled to take effect on the 91st day after sine die, and I'm concerned that there may be a lag in there, depending on when we can get the hell out of the building. But but we'll be hopeful.
Let's leave something for us to motivate us to get out of the building, you know, before October this year. Any other comments?
I just couldn't resist.
Clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Dienfeller.
Aye.
Representative Crop.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. So, House Bill 2259, having received the support of the committee, will be going to Ways and Means with our comments on it. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2259, and we'll open a work session, or a public hearing on House Bill 2255. And
House Bill 2255 allows the Department of Human Services to assess per connection fee on water suppliers to administer the federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Again, this bill will have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, do we have a list of people?
I'm assuming Grant's up first.
I beg your pardon. Grant Higginson with DHS.
Good morning, Chair Jensen,
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state public health officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to ask for your support for House Bill 2255, which, as Pete Test just mentioned, would authorize the department to assess a biennial fee paid by public water suppliers so that we can then access the money from the federal government for us to provide a high-quality, safe drinking water program. We would be getting an additional about $2.5 million for the program. 1.4 of that would come from the federal government, from the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and then the $1.1 million in matching fees would come from the assessment of fees to public water suppliers. This is an issue that actually has been around with us for a while. During the 2001 legislative session, we presented to the House Committee on Water and Environment the report from the Secretary of State audit, as well as the findings from the Environmental Protection Agency that does an annual review of our program. And what both of those reports said was that there are significant issues that need to be addressed in the safe drinking water program if we're to have the highest quality program. And while we agreed that there were some things that we could do within existing resources, we also noted, and I believe the committee agreed, that there were significant new resources that would be needed if we were going to address all the problems that had been identified. And so consequently, we agreed with the committee that we would come back this legislative session with a proposal for how we were going to raise the money for those program improvements. And we clearly recognize that given the current state of the budget, the general fund was not going to be likely available, and consequently what we are proposing in our policy package number 166 that has been incorporated into the governor's balanced budget is the idea of collecting fees in order to come up with the state match, in order for us to come up with the federal match from the federal dollars from the EPA. The state drinking water program has actually been with us for quite a while now. In 1985, the legislature authorized the department to have what we call primacy, and this is basically saying that the state runs the drinking water program rather than the federal government. Up until 1985, it was run by the federal EPA. And when we went for primacy in 1985, there was very strong support from the public water suppliers, from drinking water organizations, and the public health community. I think, as you all know, that the advances that we've made in public health and protecting the public from disease does have a lot to do with making sure that we have clean air, clean water, healthy food, and so having a strong drinking water program is very important. We think that we have made a good decision in having primacy, and that there have been some major improvements in the drinking water program since we took over in 1985. 340 communities have made significant water system improvements in their drinking water programs. The compliance with testing and reporting has improved since that time. And also the last large-scale community water disease outbreak we had in Oregon was in 1993. So we've been now 10 years without a major waterborne illness outbreak, and that's in contrast to what we saw in the 1970s and the 1980s. But also over that period of time that we've had the program, there have been a number of workload issues that have meant increased responsibilities for the program. For instance, in 1986 and 1996, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act increased the number of issues, the number of contaminants that we needed to be testing for. They have risen over that period of time from 23 to 95 that we need to be testing for, and more requirements for those testings is on the way. And just to mention a couple of those, in the near future we're going to have to be testing for arsenic and viruses in groundwater, for cryptosporidium in surface water, and for chemical byproducts for any of those systems that are disinfecting with chlorine. in addition to the number of reporting requirements that have been imposed on the program, we've also seen an increase in the number of drinking water systems. Over 700 new drinking water systems have come into Oregon since that time, going from about 2,900, almost 3,000, to now almost 3,700 drinking water systems. And the majority of these systems are relatively small, serving 500 people or less, and so they are systems that require a substantial amount of technical assistance and consultation. And we've also had additional program requirements as well, and we currently run the state drinking water revolving loan fund program, which is a program that provides low interest loans to drinking water systems who want to make improvements to their drinking water program. This, in fact, is one of the main reasons why we think that primacy is very important to the state of Oregon. So far, we have received from the federal government over $100 million over the last 10 years to support the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund. And if we lose primacy, which is a possibility in the future if we do not improve the program, if we lose primacy, then we lose that Drinking Water Revolving Fund program. As I mentioned, that even though we've had all of these increases in responsibilities and growth of the program, the increase in staff has really not been able to keep up with this workload. And this is despite the fact that there actually are additional extra federal dollars available for us. As I mentioned, right now on the table is $1.4 million from EPA that we are simply unable to access because we do not have the matching funds. And so consequently, that is exactly what we're trying to do here in 2255 is to get those additional dollars so that we can match those with what's available to us from the Environmental Protection Agency. We do think that this is an important issue, that we need to be addressing these problems that have been identified. We do want to make sure that we're meeting the minimum standards that are required by the U.S. EPA. And just to mention some of the things that we would plan on doing is making sure that we have staff available to enforce all sampling and testing requirements, to respond to all violations of regulations, to improve monitoring of water samples analyzed by certified laboratories, and to adopt and enforce all U.S. EPA regulations, and to make sure that we're conducting the sanitary surveys of our water systems as required by law at least every 5 years. I'm not sure if you have received it in your packet yet, but you should be getting a letter from the Region 10 Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and they note a number of deficiencies, and I'll just read first this one sentence. We have recently completed the annual review of Oregon's drinking water program and continue to believe that the program is behind in several critical functions from the 1986 Safe Drinking Water Act that are important to the integrity of the drinking water program. I will highlight several of the areas below, and there's four. One is that there's a large number of drinking water systems that are out of compliance. Almost 20% of the drinking water systems in Oregon are currently out of compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. That we lack, number two, that we lack water systems inspections. There's about 30% of the water systems who have not received their required sanitary survey in the 3 to 5 year period that they were supposed to have received those in. Number three was the lack of groundwater determinations. We're supposed to be assessing whether or not groundwater, that's like well water, is being affected by contaminated surface water, and only 30% of those groundwater systems that we should have checked have been checked so far. And then fourth and finally, the EPA recognizes that there are going to be substantial increased workload issues over the next 5 years, and just simply for that we need staff as well. To be fair and honest here, the EPA is not saying that they would remove primacy from the state of Oregon right now and retake over the program, but this certainly is something that is a possibility in the future if we do not address this issue of inadequate staff resources at the present time. And so with that, I'll close asking for your support of the bill and be happy to answer any questions. And I have our technical staff person, Dave Leland, who's the head of our drinking water program, with me as well.
Representative Kurtz.
Yeah. Grant, what's the match rate?
Well, it's 1.1 of our dollars to 1.4 federal dollars, so between 50 and 60%.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about how is the program currently funded? Is that out of general funds?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder. Currently, we get about $1.5 million in general, no, $1.2 million in general fund, and the rest is either from EPA or some other funds.
Follow up. So this the fee would be supplementing the general fund that is already funding the, I think you said 33 FTEs currently. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I believe that's correct.
Get an affirmative nod, I guess.
Yes, yes. And that would be an increase of about 16 new staff, and that's still substantially less than the number of staff that EPA would like to see the program have, but we think that that is a reasonable match. And as I said, that's fully matching what's currently on the table from EPA.
I have one more follow-up.
If
I'm reading this bill right, this is from public water suppliers only that the fee would be collected. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that is correct. It would be from the suppliers themselves. It would be charged per connection. So basically, it is a user fee, but it would come through the drinking water providers.
So, follow up. So, private. How do you assess a fee for private suppliers, such as, I'm assuming, like mobile home parks or small subdivisions that are on well water or such?
Let me make sure you. Your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Leland, and I'm the manager of the drinking water program for the Department of Human Services. And Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, public water systems do include the private suppliers also. The term public is simply for a statutory term. So I presume we would collect that fee in the similar manner from anybody who is a public water system.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I just want you to know I support clean water. I support your efforts, so don't take this personally, but I'm going to couch this question the way it was presented to me. How can I justify asking people that live in a water district that is complying with all these and they are meeting all these standards, charging them to go out and make those out there that aren't complying comply? That's a very delicate question, and I need an answer to it.
Chair Jensen, Representative Schlaffer, the way we look at it is a system, and there is in any system there are going to be some components that are stronger than others, but you need that core infrastructure and be able to identify any problem that comes up and to be able to have the staff to help to resolve those problems if you're going to do anything with that system. So even though there may be some programs that are complying 100% with everything, I do think it's the responsibility for us to have a solid public program and that everybody needs to contribute to that program.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. But hang on just a second for my observations. While you have heard me address the committee that these are bills that are referred to Ways and Means, and it is up to Ways and Means to deal with the, really the money issue as such. But I do think there is a policy issue present here that borders on maybe the jurisdiction of Ways and Means that I would like to point out to you. The chair has some difficulty proposing for the department an additional FTE in a economic climate that we are in the state of Oregon today as a policy issue as such. One of the things that my mail and everything that I've gotten from the public seems to emphasize is additions, the opposition to additional programs and or additional FTE. I'm merely leaving you at this point with that, recognizing we're only in a public hearing today, and you may have opportunity to comment on that at a later date.
And Chair Jensen, I do appreciate that comment, and do recognize that during these critical budget crunch times, that the idea of increasing government is one that is difficult to swallow. On the other hand, as I mentioned before, having good clean water is of critical importance to the public health and safety of the people of Oregon, and it is from two independent outside of Oregon government, outside of our drinking water program sources, that the recognition of the need to increase the level of resources to that program was being reported. So while I understand your comment, we still strongly believe that this is something that needs to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a whole group, I think, from cities. About four of you. Would you like to come up, all of you together? And we've got Susan Snyder, City of Portland, Willa Tiffany with League of Oregon Cities, Amanda, I hope I'm saying that correct, Rich with the Tri-County Water, and Doug Riggs with the Central Oregon Cities Organization. They won't let you squeeze a chair in there some way, Doug? I mean,
they don't move.
No, all right.
You're in the whole row.
Slow person out of the, you know.
Yes.
Susan, you're first on the list. Do you want to, you're going to, Willie is going to carry the ball?
Well, I'll just lead off, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for allowing us to testify today, Mr. Chair. The League of Oregon Cities represents 238 cities across the state of Oregon, every city with a population in the state of Oregon. We are adamantly opposed to House Bill 2255, and I think, Mr. Chair, you outlined part of our issue with this bill. We are happy in the Ways and Means process. There's an adequate vehicle down there. It's called the Department of Human Services budget, and we are more than willing to go down there and talk about the program and the appropriate level of the program. However, the policy question facing you today in this bill is, should the state be allowed to control local water utility bills for state general services? We are not opposed to fee-for-service legislation or fee-for-service programs. We are involved in a number of fee-for-service programs with natural resource agencies across the board. We do have questions about the level of fees and fee-for-service, but that's not the question we think this bill poses for you today. We would be opposed to any fee level under this type of arrangement. Let me remind folks here that we are public, not-for-profit entities. We utilize, and we are also slated under statute to provide for the public health, welfare, and safety of our citizens. That's why we're created. Public drinking water systems utilize rates to pay for the capital, maintenance, and infrastructure required to provide, to provide that clean water to their citizens. And those elected officials that govern those boards and those city councils are personally liable to provide not only clean water, but provide for the public health and welfare. This bill takes that control right out of their hands. We think it could have also a detrimental impact for some communities who have difficulty with fee-raising issues. We understand the state has budgetary issues as well. We in local government have had budgetary issues over the last 20 years that are very similar. And some of those rate issues are very controversial. Allowing a state agency to set a rate at any level they deem fit could have detrimental impacts in the ability for those local communities to provide that capital infrastructure and that maintenance that provides the level of service their citizens need and want. So I guess I'll just, before I pass it along, I want to kind of give you a scenario that puts it kind of in the state context, how we see the issue. You're all familiar with the National Marine Fisheries Service. They implement the Federal Endangered Species Act here in the state of Oregon. We see House Bill 2255 akin to NIMS going to Congress and asking Congress for authority over State of Oregon angling fees to pay for additional staff, a 50% increase in their staffing level to run the federal ESA here in Oregon without any input or any authority from the state legislature. That's a similar scenario to the state-local relationship in 2255. We think that's unfair, and we think it's bad policy, and we ask you to oppose it.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today on this bill. I'm Susan Schneider of the City of Portland Government Relations Office. The City of Portland joins the League of Oregon Cities in opposing this bill. We believe it's bad public policy, and it has some practical problems as well. I won't repeat the points and issues that Willie has raised, but I would like to add that I think the state has mechanisms of its own if it is, if you are convinced that it is important to increase this program, there are mechanisms available to the state to do that, such as the surcharge on the income tax form, for example. We oppose this effort to attach a fee to water bills of primarily urban water users for a program for which there's little relationship between the immediate fee payer and the program. The benefits from such an expanded program, as I think you heard the department testify, basically extend to the state as a whole and in normal times are supported by general fund. And we believe that's the appropriate way to support such a program. We particularly oppose this effort in these times. What is the message to ratepayers with an effort like this? The kinds of desperate calls you've received over the last several weeks from all sorts of people who desperately need the state's help, everything from human services to schools, and we, you know, you're all struggling with how we deal with that, and but we turn around and fund 16 new positions in the health department to solve what desperate problem in Oregon's drinking water. It seems the testimony you heard, the state is not in immediate danger of losing primacy, which is a concern to all of us. So we would oppose this bill. We urge you to oppose this bill and to please not send it to Ways and Means where it can be used later in the session to create other mischief. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Amanda?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and Tri-County Water Resources Association. I echo my colleagues' sentiments in regard to this bill. We are opposed to this bill for a few reasons, actually, those that my colleagues have mentioned. And in addition, we do see a public policy issue here with using local water suppliers as essentially a tax collecting agent for basically a state tax on water sales. And we don't see any impetus to go down this road and create that precedent. We also oppose it because we see a real imbalance being created by a mechanism of this nature. You're creating a per-connection fee. Therefore, the largest cities and the largest districts are going to be paying the most, the lion's share of this expansion of the program. However, they are the least likely to be using the expansion of the program. So there is a real disconnect between those who will be paying for the lion's share again of this program and those who will be using it. We just take issue with that imbalance. And I guess finally, we're unclear on exactly what is being bought, and then I guess to make matters worse, we're unclear on how much we're going to be paying for it because the bill is silent on the total assessment that will be brought to achieve this expansion. So that, I guess, concludes our concerns, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. question.
Representative Tolman.
Thank you, and I'm not sure who would like to respond to this, but I guess it comes up thinking about what you've just said, Amanda. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that, well, you did say that the people who would be needing this service are not the people who are paying for the service. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Not, Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei. Essentially, by the division's own admission, those water systems that have the biggest, that may have the biggest problems with water quality are the smaller systems and well users. And the folks that are going to be paying for this program are your folks like, for example, a Tualatin Valley Water District that has, 50,000 plus connections. And they're not the ones that are having the problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Riggs.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here today representing the Central Oregon Cities Organization. That includes Bend, Redmond, Madras, Sisters, Metolius, and Culver, east of the mountains, very close to your district, Mr. Chair. I wanted to join my colleagues here today in expressing some concerns over this bill, and it is certainly something that we believe that needs further discussion before it has moved on to the Ways and Means Committee. Let me make a central point, which is we tend to agree that losing primacy over these types of issues would be a serious threat to Oregon and certainly to the cities that I represent. Having said that, I think it's interesting that if you look at Mr. Higginson's testimony in his last paragraph, he mentions that we are not at an immediate risk of losing primacy, so we have some time to be able to deal with this. But we are concerned about an effort to take this type of a step at this point in time. The second point I make is that this is a two-way street. Cities comply with numerous mandates that the state puts upon them in a variety of different areas, and we very seldom turn around and tell the state that we have to assess a fee to implement the state programs that are being run by the cities. And so in our mind, this ought to be part of a broader discussion about who pays for which services. Many of the technical issues that I was going to discuss have already been covered, but let me simply say that we'd be happy to sit down, work with the committee, work together in a work group, have an interim work group to discuss this issue, but at this point in time, we would not support moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this group? Thank you very much. I might just comment about the unfairness of, and it seems that Portland must be in compliance, judging from your comments, Susan. And so we take a city of, some 400,000?
That's correct.
With probably 150,000 connections, plus or minus some change. And you indicate there's some unfairness in that, but basically there is unfairness in any kind of, it seems like me, like revenue-raising measures. We put a lot of money today in our state into the public safety arena. All of us here probably pay, as all of you probably pay, substantial taxes, with a substantial portion of that going to public safety. But you're not the ones who are the offenders as such. So I appreciate your argument with this, but there is the kind of the nature of taxation, I guess, and whether you like to call this a tax or whether you want to call it something else, it comes, user fees or taxes of just a different form. Having said that, it's just my comments going along the way for you with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have Liz Frankel, is that correct? Good morning, Liz.
Thank you. I'm Liz Frankel. I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm going to read the first paragraph and then I'm going to extemporize. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. The League has a long history of involvement in safe drinking water, beginning in 1967. In 1981, the League supported the safe drinking water legislation, placing administration of drinking water programs under Oregon's Health Department with supplemental funds from general funds. We supported the primacy. In 2001, the League supported 2239, requiring small public water systems to be in compliance with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. I just came from another committee, another House committee, and there was something of a similar debate going on. And one of the more esteemed business lobbyists was making the point that there is a connection between money and program, which I thought was a rather interesting comment. We all deal with that. You have your idealistic level about the perfect program, and then you have your pragmatic approach to how to fund the program. The League is in support of this legislation, and part of the reason for that support probably goes to the fact that money and program are related. I would remind the committee that there is also a connection between economic health and development, infrastructure, and safe drinking water. Ultimately, it seems to me right now that the choice is probably how you're going to deal with a solid, forward-looking, safe drinking water program when you know that you aren't going to be able to fund that program out of general funds. So I thank you for your consideration and ask that you make our written testimony part of the public record. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Liz. Are there any questions for Ms. Franco? Thank you. At this point, we will close then. Is there anyone else who wanted to, before I do that, testify on House Bill 2255? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2255 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2253. I believe the department was here, or part of the department was here. The main part of the department.
House Bill 2253 modifies and restructures schedule of fees for Division of State Lands Removal and Fill Program, exempts habitat restoration projects from removal and fill permit fees, subjects emergency authorizations for removal and fill permit fee structure, allows 45 days to submit payment after emergency authorization, establishes fee for action under general authorization, declares emergency effective July 1, 2003. This also has a referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Ah, the department has arrived. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Are you ready to proceed?
Proceed.
Sorry I'm late to stepped out for just a moment. I'm John Lilly, the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. I'm here today to speak to you about House Bill 2253. House Bill 2253 restructures the removal fill permit program fee schedule, and Basically, we see that the policy issues are of two types, and maybe closely related. One is that how much should the permit applicants contribute to support the removal fill program? And secondly, what percent of the program's operating costs should be paid for by applicants? Just as an overview at this point, for those of you who may not be familiar with the state's removal fill program, the Division of State Lands is authorized under state law to regulate the filling and removal of materials from the beds and banks of waterways of the state and wetlands. Typically, a project that exceeds 50 cubic yards requires a permit, although in some cases activities such as maintenance of existing structures or do not require a permit, even though that work might exceed 50 cubic yards. And other circumstances in special environmental areas such as state scenic waterways or essential salmon habitat, there is a zero cubic yard requirement. That so, but actually it's 1 cubic yard for non-motorized activities is allowed without permit, but anything else would require an individual permit or what we call a general authorization. There are three types of authorizations that the agency issues: an individual permit, a general authorization, and emergency authorization. An individual permit is just as I described, an individual permit for an individual type of project, usually of a larger nature, and one that must follow certain, is evaluated individually. The fees are established in administrative rule and in state law. The majority of the work that the division does are in terms of authorizing projects actually are done through the general authorization process, and a bit different than the individual permit. An individual permit, the division under state law has 40 days to review a complete application and then 90 days to make the permit decision. A general authorization, the permit decision is made in actually 40 days under our administrative rule. An emergency authorization is exactly what it sounds like. It's authorization usually done verbally over the telephone to an individual or entity doing work to protect a structure or a road or something of that nature as a result of a flood event or something like that. So that's the overview of the program as it currently works. We, on an annual basis, probably issue in the neighborhood of 1,000 authorizations per year. It fluctuates from year to year. Two biennium ago, we issued almost 1,500 authorizations a year. Now, directly to the bill. On my handout that I've given you, you can see under the subject heading of what the bill does, there are some brief bullets there that give you an idea. First, the bill would restructure the fee schedule for all removal fill authorizations. Currently, only individual permits require a fee. General authorizations are free, and emergency authorizations are free. This bill would require fees for all of those types of authorizations. We would be combining removal and fill volumes into one fee schedule. Currently, there are two fee schedules, one for fills and one for removals. And depending on the project, the higher rate is applied depending upon which is the dominant type of activity, either removal or fill. What this bill does is combines the two together. So if you have 500 yards of fill and 500 yards of removal, it would be 1,000 yards of material that's being excavated or moved in waters of the state. The fee would be calculated on that basis. So from 0 to 1,000 cubic yards, there would be no volume fee, but a base fee of $300. That covers about 49% of our permits.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Cruz. So you're rolling the below 50 into this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, only if the activity requires a permit in essential salmon habitat, yes.
But the standard exemption for below 50 still exists and it's not subject to this fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, could you rephrase your question? I'm lost here.
Okay. Currently, below 50 cubic yards, you're not required, unless it's essential habitat, you're not required to get a permit or anything. As I read this bill, this might include the below 50 because it's 0-2.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, in those circumstances where a permit is required for an activity less than 50 yards under current state law, if this bill were to pass, then a fee would be required for those activities.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, what happens to this issue of 50 cubic yards if you achieve the assumption goal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, under a bill passed last session, Senate Bill 172, which made a number of provisional changes in state law to enable the state to have a program of equivalency to the Section 404 Clean Water Act program, if the state were able to assume that program, then the 50-yard limitation would no longer be in place, or the 50-yard exemption, if you want to call it that, would no longer be in place. However, there would still be activities that would be exempt or provisionally exempt from regulation, whether or not they were less than 50 yards or more than 50 yards. So in a sense, while many waters of Oregon currently under state law are not covered, or 50 yards of activity can be done in those streams without regulation, under an assumed program, there would be some regulatory oversight over those small projects. Although under Senate Bill 172, the legislature contemplated that there would be a general authorization, actually a no-notice general authorization, that would cover small activities or small projects of that nature. So no notice would be, you wouldn't require to notice the agency, and I suspect it would not be required to have the permit in hand. It would be covered by the general authorization.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, help me. Let me read that back to you so I've got this straight. If assumption is achieved under the prior legislation that we had passed, then the 50-yard issue generally goes away because anything under 50 yards is covered under the assumption issue. But you're saying that anything under 50 yards would require a permit where it isn't now, but that generally you could go ahead and do it because it's covered under general authorization. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, something similar to that.
Okay.
In hopes of clarifying, sir.
Thank you.
There are three areas or three parameters that one has to weigh to determine if an activity is subject to the state's removal fill law. One is volume, the volume of the activity undertaken. Second is the activity itself. And third is the location. Obviously, if you're digging 50 cubic yards out of upland dry land, that's not a water or wetland of the state. There's no regulation. There's no removal fill requirement to get a state permit for that. If it's 50 yards or less in order to repair an existing structure, such as a riprap on a stream bank, that does not require a permit. If it's under current state law, if it's 49 yards in a wetland in the city of Salem, that's permissible without, you can do that kind of activity without a permit. Now, under 404 assumption, 49 yards in a wetland within the city of Salem would be within the state's authority to require a permit, but this general authorization hopefully will cover those kinds of activities, and that's allowed under the bill that was passed in the last legislative session. So hopefully I've clarified that a bit. Mr. Chair, I would be glad to go on a little farther if you like.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. So that may, the general authorization then does or does not require a permit for under that 49-yard or the, under that 50-yard scenario in the city of Salem or anywhere else for that matter.
Mr. Chair, yeah, good question. Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, if we're operating, if you're operating under that no notice general authorization, you do not need to have the paperwork in hand from the Division of State Lands.
But Mr. Chair, but you're still eventually going to have to get a permit.
No, sir. The no notice general authorization will be a general permit type of thing that will enable you to do the work, provided you follow the terms and conditions of that permit, which will be noticed for you. Those small projects will likely be monitored on a complaint-driven basis.
Okay, and one last question, Mr. Chair. So if it's not required to have a permit under the 50 yards, there will be some requirement to document that, I would assume, and will there be a cost attached to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the general authorization is the permit.
Okay.
Okay. It's semantic. The family of authorizations under the division under the removal fill law are emergency authorizations, general authorizations, and individual permits. In this case, as what we've been describing here, is a type of general authorization. So it's a type of permit. It's a type of authorization. It's okay to go ahead and do your work. Since there wouldn't be an application, there would not be a requirement for a fee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, John.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I've come from city government, so some of this is very new to me. We were moving in city government toward requiring applicants to pay the full cost of the fee process, and it's somewhat surprising to me to see that the share of program costs borne by the applicants is so low. Can you explain that to me?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei. Over the years since the late 60s when the program was first developed, thinking was that a percentage of the program would be underwritten by application fees and the remaining costs of the program would be underwritten by revenues that come from people who use waterways for various purposes. For example, marinas, sand and gravel operations, easements, fiber optic cables coming in over the territorial sea, things of that nature form the other part of the picture, providing the funding to the program. I think that what we've focused here as a policy question is just where you're going. Exactly what should be the proper balance between folks who are contributing through those royalties, et cetera, for proprietary uses of state-owned submerged and submersible land, and those who are applying and receiving the permit through the state's removal fill program. Over the years, I think the contribution from application fees to the program costs have varied from as low as the 11 to 13% that we have now up to as much as 65%.
Thank you, John.
Colleagues, I'm going to ask your indulgence on questions now. We've got a number of people who want to testify on this bill. We're not doing a work session today, and we probably will do some additional public hearing on the bill. But in order to give you an overview of where people are going to be at on the bill and maybe give you some other questions when we bring the bill back up, we'd like to try to get everybody that we can heard this morning. So if you could summarize quickly for us, John.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time. The handout I've given you, I believe, covers a great deal of information for you. You can see here that we have some reasoning as to why we think the bill ought to be passed. It increases the contribution of the applicants to underwriting the program to about 20 to 25%. We believe there's a more equitable sharing of the costs by requiring some application fees in association with emergency authorizations and GAs, which represent about half of our work that currently we're not requiring any application fee for at this time. It would raise an additional $400,000, which would then offset other revenues, and the difference then would in all likelihood flow to the common school fund principal. I think I need to talk about something about who might oppose. You'll probably hear some of this, and I often like to highlight who might be the supporters and detractors. We have heard from entities that are concerned about the cost recovery idea. We have identified about 14% of our projects are in excess of 10,000 cubic yards. The best indicator that we have right now in terms of trying to identify what level of effort is needed to issue a permit is one associated with volume. It may not be the perfect surrogate for determining that or perfect indicator, but it's the best one we have at this point. I've given you some examples in the sheets that follow the testimony here that outline different ways in which the fee might be calculated, and one of those is a cost recovery idea. And finally, I would say that, two things to close. One is that there are a number of activities that the agency currently provides, or services that the division currently provides under this program at no cost. And on page 3 of the handout, you can see a list of those activities. Now, those programs are part of the removal fill, or those tasks are part of the removal fill program. So they're covered by these one of two sources, either the waterway revenues or the removal fill permit fees. And then the other thing I would mention is that we think that the program would be well served to have this modest increase in the fees. I don't think it necessarily compares poorly with in an outlandish way with similar fees that are charged, say, at the local government level. It would help a bit to shift this burden from revenues coming from other sources into the common school fund principal. Mr. Chair, that's all I have. I'd be glad to take any more questions if you like.
Thank you, John. We'll have, I'm sure, questions when we come back for you with this bill, and I'm sure you want to be here at that time. So.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Chuck Bennett and Lori Wimmer. Chuck with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and Lori with the Oregon Education Association. And I assume they must have amendments to attach to this to get money to go to K-12, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, no amendments, just some comments on this bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, our interest in this is relative to the Common School Fund. Proceeds from either the fee increase or the non-fee increase either are added to or subtracted from the Common School Fund principal. In this case, it appears to us there are $417,000 at stake to be added to the Common School Fund, or conversely, to represent a subsidy from the Common School Fund for this activity. Mr. Chairman, in looking at the Common School Fund, we've concluded that our organization's policy is that we would like to maximize proceeds to the Common School Fund. We think it is one of the really stable sources of funding. It's one of the growing sources of funding for education, and one we're taking a real interest in. We think if interest had been taken 30, 40 years ago, we would not be in quite the fix we're in today. The portion of the fund we're talking about here is the statutory portion of the fund. I would remind you that this is the portion that was used during the special sessions to provide nearly $18 million to balance the budget that continues to be such a problem as we deal with 0103. Mr. Chairman, the legislature is the trustee of this fund. This is a portion of the funds coming into the fund. It's not from the trust lands, but it is a portion of it that tends to feed the funds. We believe that it really is the legislature's responsibility to maximize return for the beneficiaries of the Common School Fund, the school children of Oregon. This benefits a portion of the Common School Fund And we would ask that you take a close look at this, at least with that in mind. We understand there are other issues at stake here, but we would only ask that as you look at this fee, you include the Common School Fund and the school children as part of your decision-making factors. If you arrive at a different decision relative to this fee, that's perhaps for other factors, but we would hope that as you're deciding, you'd also look at that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Lori?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association's 45,000 members. And I would like to echo what my colleague has just said about the reason we're here before you today on House Bill 2253 in its support. OEA supports the long-term stability of the Department of State Lands Managed Common School Fund. And even though this is a small amount of money you're thinking of today with respect to adding to the Common School Fund principal, we believe that we are in it for the long run, and that again, if we had paid as much attention all along to the contributions to those revenues, that perhaps the fund would be even larger today. As we understand it, this bill enables the agency's fee structure for the fill removal program to keep pace with the services it delivers, and also ensures a better return for the Common School Fund principal. And while we don't pretend to understand the intricacies of this program and its restructuring elements under the proposal, we do want the committee to know that we value the sound management of the Common School Fund Trust provided by the Division of State Lands, because their careful stewardship of this constitutional revenue source has provided a modest but valuable local funding pot for Oregon's public school children. And it's our understanding that this bill seeks to both update the service versus cost dynamic and also to spread the cost burden to program users. And so therefore we urge your aye vote, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if I can ask a couple of you to come up together, Tom Quintal and John Oshel, correct?
Close.
Counts in horseshoes, but.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell, also John O'Shell. I use both. I am the County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Our association with this permit program is primarily through our road activities, although we do run into it on some other issues. A couple overview things. Understand first, we certainly are not opposed to this program. We think it is a good program, provides a valuable service to the county road departments, and that basically DSL serves as a good clearinghouse of all the agencies and interested parties, make sure that our projects, in fact, are done in an environmentally sound manner, which is important to us. As far as the general overview and the concept of increasing fees, of course, we always moan and whine when fees are increased, but we also understand they're necessary. Probably the one that got the biggest flinch was when the proposal to remove the exemption on the riprap and slope stabilization, because that is what the vast majority of our permits are. It's a combination of that and bridge replacements. On the other hand, we also got to acknowledge that, you know, counties are always, you folks, whenever you're proposing property tax exemptions and opposing every exemption in the world, so maybe we're a little bit awkward place to object to an exemption here. As far as the fee structure increase, we anticipate you folks will take a look at that, come up with a policy decision on that, and that's not the major thrust of our comments this morning. We had two areas of concern. The first one was the proposal to change how we are counting volumes when you have a project that is a fill and a removal both. Almost all of our projects are exactly that. It's when you're doing a bridge, you take the footing out, and that's removal, and you put a footing back, and that's the fill. The slope stabilization, you usually pull something out to get the toe stabilized, then you put the whatever you're going to put back, whether it be riprap or a vegetation system, and they're combination ones. The existing state law says basically if you've got one that has both, you take whichever's the larger number, and that's the size of your permit. The proposed change is now we add both of them together, What that does, of course, that puts us into a potentially a higher threshold for a fee structure. That also, there are some thresholds within the processes as to what your requirements are on different volumes. So we have a concern about the proposal to increase the way we count the volumes. I mean, once again, if the need is for a higher fee for certain volumes, we'll accept your judgment on that. But we really are opposed on how that is measured, and we would rather see the language that is in the existing law on that issue. Our major opposition comes with the proposal to start on the larger permits over 10,000 to go time and materials with no cap. We always oppose this type of proposal. It has been our experience, and this, once again, is not directed at Division of State Lands, because frankly, they're a pretty good group of people. But our experience is, if you give one agency the power to spend another agency's money with no cap, it grows. What happens is the individual staff will do things that they would not do if they had to pay for it themselves. And whether it be, and frankly, most of the problems we've had have been with DEQ, who've had some programs where they could sort of unlimited charge us. The numbers grew quite large. And so we are quite opposed to any type of proposal that says, just with no controls, no checks and balances, one agency is allowed to increase permit fees based on what they think the level of effort is needed, is not good policy. We would suggest as an alternative that they maybe look at some other ways of measuring. There are, I would suspect, certain activities that do run their fees up quite a bit. I've suggested a couple. One, of course, is when you run into riparian, that increases quite a bit of, mitigation of wetland areas, does drive their costs up quite a bit, and maybe it's appropriate to start putting some fees on that. Some of the ones we've used in local government to solve a lot of problems is sometimes we put a fee on it if they can't get concurrence of the neighbors, which really puts the developer much more online to work with the neighbors before he proposes the project. And so sometimes we put fees on some of our programs for that. Just some ideas to, in lieu of the just open-ended time and materials, but as I said, main opposition to this bill is that open-ended time and materials concept. Questions?
Thank you, John. I appreciate as we said, we'll be coming back to this issue, so we'll save our questions for right now. At this point, Tom?
Chair Jensen and members of the committee, my name is Tom Quintel, and I'm a resident of Salem. Basically, I am here as a small-scale miner. I'm not representing any organization. I have a few concerns a little bit about this particular bill from the standpoint of some of the things that have taken place here. In the past, the general authorization for small-scale placer mining recreational type has been exempt from the general authorization in the past, and under the administrative rule, it's the old rule, 141-89-50, that currently has been dropped under the new removal fill guidelines, and we understand that the state budgets are tight, and we also understand that there is no free lunch, and I'm sure down the road someday there's going to be a fee on this type of activity. However, looking at the general authorizations for this type of activity, and that's not to include the ones that John Lilly mentioned, but it represents approximately 578 permits. Of that 578, there's about 241 of those that are out of state. Of course, I'd have no problem with if they want to put a fee on out-of-state to offset some of the in-state people, that wouldn't bother me an awful lot because, frankly, some of the out-of-state, like California, I know, does that very thing. What I would like to say is that I believe there's room for more streamlining in our particular type of general authorization permit. Last year, I know I had some time spent with the agency and different individuals and with John Lilly a little bit, and the idea of making our permit less time-consuming for their people to administer, and as I understand, it may have resulted in possibly 50% reduction in their time to implement our permit. And in one of their publications last year, I think it was in April, they had a nice write-up on that issue about the streamlining process. I think there's further room to streamline the process. A lot of the miners are very against the Washington permitting system. This is the hydraulic project approval book. Very simple. They print this out. This goes out to G.I. Joe's, BLM, and other agencies that want to hand these out. They're free. There isn't a non-resident fee for that permit. I think there may have to be a few changes in legislation to allow something like that to happen. But speaking with Pat Chapman, who actually wrote this book, it's highly restrictive. They are primarily interested in protecting fish, which I'm sure our Fish and Wildlife, as well as Division of State Lands and so forth, are in tune to doing the same. But I really believe that there's a good example of here of how we could further streamline the permit to reduce time spent on administrating it. Basically, I don't have any other, things that I'd like to say, although I do notice in their part of their ORS 196-795, under their streamlining process of the removal fill, that is one of their key things to do, and I would certainly like to see them put more emphasis on that. I, again, would be more than happy to help work with the agency to do that. So if you have any questions, I'd be free to answer those.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate your testimony here today, and we'll probably be asking you some more questions as we proceed along with this bill. Let's see. We have Tim Kramer, and could I also have Mel Stewart and Glenn Stonebrink come up at the same time?
And my apologies to all of you. We are currently over time, so brevity would be
as appreciated as if you can, understanding we will be back with the issue later. I think first, Tim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Kramer. I am the Director of Government Affairs for Oregon Independent Miners. Over the past 8 years, OIM has built a very good working relationship with DSL, DEQ, and ODF&W, and is at this time building a relationship with Parks and Resources Department. It is because of this relationship that OIM is presently in discussions with DSL and the other affected agencies creating a new permit system for the small-scale miner. This new permit system will not only protect the environment, it will also allow the small-scale mining community to operate with ease of compliance. It also brings consistency and simplicity to the permit system, which OIM and the state agencies such as DSL have been working on for years. DSL and OIM have worked together over the years to solve many issues that face not only the agencies but also the stakeholders and citizens trying to work with our agencies. We understand the need to finally place a fee on general authorizations, of which have never had a fee placed on them. The Division of State Lands is one of our few regulatory agencies, and we must have the financial backing to complete their mission. It is for these reasons that OIM supports the passage of House Bill 2253. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, Tim. Mel Stewart.
Hi, my name is Mel Stewart. I live here in Salem. I don't represent any group, but I thank you for your time.
I have access to the DSL database, and I took a look at who these 10,000-yard permittees are. I just thought I might read a few of these names into the record so we could tell who these bad guys are that we're going to tax here. Port of Portland, Jackson County Roads, McMinnville, you know, Water and Light, City of Hillsboro, City of Salem, U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, City of Roseburg, Portland Golf Club, Nature Conservancy, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Transportation. I think we should tax these people heavily. They certainly deserve it, right? Anyway, I'll leave this entire list. There's about 27 permits per year that exceed the 10,000 cubic yard limit, and I thought you might be interested in who's paying the tax here. On the 50 cubic yard thing, I thought Mr. Cruz's question was totally appropriate. I understood it immediately. What we're doing here is later on in the legislative session, they're going to consider this 50 cubic yard issue and decide whether it's appropriate or not. And if they decide that it is appropriate, those people would then fall into this bill. Even if there's a general authorization, DSL would be able to suspend this general authorization at will, forcing the people back into the taxing scheme. So all those people that are 50 cubic yards and less, really don't know that this applies to them, and they could have an opportunity to testify at this hearing and aren't here because they really don't know that, it may apply to them. Which brings up my last thing. There are several pieces of legislation here at the legislature that restructure DSL and streamline the process with the help of the legislature that may actually require considerably less people, considerably less manpower. And it seems appropriate to first determine the tasking of this organization, what we want them to achieve, and then try to match the funding to that tasking.
Mel, I'm not sure that it passed over me, but did you give your name? And
I did, Mel Stewart.
Okay, thank you. Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Mr. Committee Administrator. My name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this issue I also represent the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. First, the basic premise to pay a fee to the government to get permission to own and use private property is wrong. When the public, through public laws, restrict the use of private property, the public should actually pay the landowner, not the other way around. What we need today is less government and less cost to the public. Presently, a landowner must get two permits to be able to operate on their property in so-called wetlands, one from the Division of State Lands and one from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Now, this is duplication, unnecessarily cost and burden to the private landowner. And as was mentioned earlier by Mr. John Lilly from the Division of State Lands, these fees still only pay a portion of the cost of government. So we know that there's an additional cost to the state to administer the permitting process dealing with wetlands. This is a duplication. It's not necessary. The best solution is to deal with only one one government agency, and we have to deal with them unless we could change federal law, but that's U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and remove all authority of this state over wetlands on private property. It saves money, helps our school fund, and lets people move forward with less government. I'd ask you to defeat this bill.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your testimony. Again, we will be back later on this bill and assume you'll probably be here if we have any questions for you at that time. I have two more people that we'd like to, and my indulgence of the committee members who can, and of Dave Babbitt for hanging in here, and Rich Angstrom, if you would come up, Rich. And Again, my apologies for the lateness of the time. As brief as you can, please, and we'll save our questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Babbitts. I own and operate Thompson's Mills, Oregon's oldest water-powered mill. I didn't have any prepared testimony, but I just felt I had to speak to some of the issues on this. Currently, we have to pay, we're supposed to pay $150 a year. And if I read the bill correctly, it's going to bump us up over $1,000 to do removal. If we do not do our removal, all of our fish ladders will stop running. So that's a fairly large issue. We do not get any cost recovery from the removal, other than in the normal course of our other operations. We don't get any direct benefit from the rock that we remove. It just sits in a big pile. So if we're going to have to pay thousands of dollars or over $1,000 to do our removal projects, then we're probably going to have to look to doing more removal rather than less, and attempt to start selling the rock to recover some of the costs, which is something that we really would rather not do. We don't want to be in the rock business. One of the other things that we have had problems with the Division of State Lands on this issue is the definition of a private operator versus a commercial operator. And I'm not sure how the amendments to this statute will change that. But currently, it's somewhat ambiguous in the definition, and we've always felt that commercial operators should be somebody that makes their living by removing and selling the rock rather than somebody that just has a business name as opposed to a private individual. In the sake of time, I will conclude right now.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Good morning. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. We're heavily involved with the Division of State Lands through commercial gravel extraction, and I very much appreciated some of the comments that we've heard here today. It makes me think that folks are thinking along the same line, that the department needs to be supported, but at what level and how? And our issue is on the how side of things. OCAPA is governed by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, which handles the upland side of things, and our fees through DOGAMI are all volume-based, and it works very well. We have said to the Division of State Lands, which currently has been more of a fixed fee type of program, that they should move and try to mirror DOGAMI's fee structure in some kind of fashion and go to a volume-based fee structure. Rationale for that is that both the in-water operators and the out-of-water operators compete against one another, and we'd like to see an even playing field, obviously, where government's concerned. The sand and gravel royalties that are raised from the commercial sand and gravel folks are about $1 million, and those are statutory revenues that are some of it goes to the Common School Fund, and some of it goes to the and goes to help support the program. We have two reasons we're not in support of this bill at this time, and we're willing to sit down with the Division of State Lands and continue working on how to fund their program in the best way. But the first one is the cost recovery issue. We were pretty good. We were doing okay with the fee structure up till the last section where they got over 10,000 yards, and they essentially had no cap and basically a blank check. The other issue has to do with the how the revenues are being spent, and which is more of a policy argument that I think this committee needs to grapple with. You heard that the folks from the Common School Fund appreciating the fact that some of those statutory revenues end up in the Common School Fund. We all support kids, and we know that the schools are in a tough situation right now. But under the present environmental regulations that are going on, especially with the National Marine Fisheries Service, the commercial sand and gravel industry is at risk of, for in-water, is at risk of going away. And if that happens, that $1 million, that portion of it goes to the Common School Fund, will dry up. It will not happen any longer. So one of the things that we want to engage in discussions with the Division of State Lands and maybe offering some amendments to this is that some of this, as we work our issues out with the It's NOAA fisheries now. I got to make that change mentally. It's hard to make that leap. NOAA fisheries is that some of the monies from those royalties and some of these fees, extra dollars, either go to salmon recovery, but more importantly, doing more research about what impacts sand and gravel removal are having on the rivers. And if the long term, there may be an immediate need to solve some issues like that out of those royalties. Long term, that will help protect and preserve the money going then back into the common school fund. So it's not as an easy as an issue as, you know, the common school fund should get all of it. There's other problems environmentally out there that the industry is facing that DSL is in a unique position to help solve, but it's going to take, from my view, looking at this issue, some dollars, investments from the state, and support of the industry. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And with that, we will close our public hearing on House Bill 22.